Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Nun Aleph from the bed by the two dots. Uve kohenet adrinech lemedinatech. Amar Rabbi, another kohen gadol, if you have a problematic marriage between a widow and a kohen gadol, a marriage which is restricted, chayav liftota, despite that fact that it's an improper marriage, he still has to redeem her. Shani koreba uve kohenet adrinech lemedinatech. Because the Tanai Ketubah vis-a-vis a Kohen to his wife is to redeem her and bring her back to Klal Yisrael. He doesn't have to bring her back as a wife. This woman, obviously, he can't bring back as a wife because he's not supposed to be married to her, but he can still be Mikayim v'adrineich l'medinatech. On the other hand, Mamzeret v'nitina l'Yisrael, if you have a marriage, again, a legal, problematic marriage between a Mamzeret v'nitina l'Yisrael, Einu chayav liftota. He's not required to redeem her. She'ein ani koreba vozvineich lilintu. Because there he can't accomplish the tnai haktubah, which is to return this woman to him as a wife. Rav Amar, kol she'isur shvia gorim la. Anything that the problem for returning this woman is caused by her being in captivity, chayav liftota. Then he's required to redeem her. Isur davar acher gorim la. If the restriction against them returning together or being a party together, then he is not required to redeem her. If you look at the simply, the machlok between Abai and Rava seems to revolve around the Ikar Takana of the Chachamim. According to Abaye, the Takana for a wife of Israel versus the wife of a Kohen were completely separate Takanot. The one with regards to Israel is a requirement or the ability to take the woman back as a wife, and therefore will be governed by those rules. On the other hand, the Kohen's Takana was simply to bring her back to the Jewish nation, not to necessarily bring her back as a wife. And there'll be nafkaminot there between cases like this, where you have a problematic marriage. For a Kohen, even in a case where there was no other problem in her marriage except for this captivity, she still would not be able to return to him as a wife because of the problem of zonah or chashash zonah. And for that reason, in these instances where there's something else, we don't worry about it because he's not required to bring this woman back as a wife. That's the way Abaye would view it. Rava, on the other hand, sees it as being a single takana. The takana is that if you have a wife, you gotta redeem her. Now, there are practical implications to that. For Yisrael, he can return her as a wife. For a Kohen, he can't return her as a wife, but that's a technicality. It's not that he's not required to redeem her. He's not required to take her back. He just can't. But the takana is a single takana, which is anytime you're married to a woman, you're going to bring her back as a wife. Okay, if you can't, because of your standing, bring her back as a wife, that's fine. But that means that if there was a problem in the marriage, there's no requirement to redeem her because the whole point here, the whole focus is on the return of one's wife. And over here, there's no wife to return because you can't be married to this individual even before you started with the captivity. Because the lashon of a Kohen is different than Yisrael. According to Abaye, that makes a difference. According to Rava, there's no difference. The same takana. It's just that's because of a Kohen, there's a practical problem. He can't take her back as a wife. For all intents and purposes, she is his wife. If he wasn't a Kohen, he'd be able to take her back. That's the standard. And so now, he can't technically, because of the Shavia, he can't take her back. That won't stop us from forcing him to redeem her. If the problem existed prior to the captivity, there was some other Isser there, then she was never supposed to be a wife to him, and then that's not governed by this Takana. No, Robert's question is, if Yisrael in this case would be able to return her as a wife, then a Kohen would be obligated. If Yisrael can't return her as a wife, then a Kohen's not obligated. He basically says that they're on par with each other, just the Kohen has a technicality, can't have this woman as a wife. But we would look at the same measure. The same measure that by Yisrael would be by a Kohen. That's the way Robert looks at it. Right, then by Yisrael, you would be able to take her back. Therefore, by the Kohen, even though he can't take her back, he still is obligated. But it's governed by the Yisrael. All we look at is what would happen for Yisrael in this case. And then we apply that to a Kohen or Kohen Gadol. The language has changed because of the technicality that the Kohen or the Kohen Gadol can't marry her no matter what because of the Shivya. But we follow the guidepost is that which happens to Yisrael. He sees it as one Takana. The Takana is, can he return her as a wife? But he says the Takana is basically, if Yisrael can return this woman as a wife, that's the obligation liftota. A Kohen will not be able to turn her because of the Shivya. But if in all other respects, Yisrael would be able to return her, then the Kohen is also obligated to return her. So Leima Kitanae. Let us suggest here that this machlok between Abaye and Rava is similar to a machlok Tanaim that we have. Madir Tishtov and Ishbet. person who is Madira Na'a from his wife, and then she's taken into captivity. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Podeh, Venotein Lach Ktubata, that he has to redeem her, and then she hands her Ktubah because they can't remain married. Because of this Neder Hana'a, they no longer have the ability to be married, because if his wife is Asur Ba'ana'at, then they can't conduct a proper marriage, and he won't be able to fulfill his obligations to his wife, and therefore demands divorce. It's not her fault. So she gets her ktubah in this divorce. But he has to first redeem her, and then give her a ktubah. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Notein la ktubata, ve'eno podeh. He gives her the ktubah, but he doesn't redeem her. Amar Rabbi Natan, sha'alti et sumkus, kishamar Rabbi Yeshua notein la ktubah, ve'eno podeh. In the case where it says that he grants her ktubah and doesn't redeem her, kishi dira lusof nishbeit. What was the scenario? Was the scenario that he first took the neder hana'ah, then she was taken into captivity? Or was she taken into captivity first, and then he took the neder? V'amarli lo shamati. He says, I didn't hear. I don't have a strong masorah about this. V'nirin devarim. But it makes sense to me to say, shehidira ulusof nishbeit. That at first there was the neder ana'ah preventing them from remaining married, and then afterwards she was taken into captivity. Diamart nishbeit ulusof hidira. Because if you think the scenario was that she was taken into captivity and then he took a neder ana'ah, ate lirume, then every person is going to do the same thing, which is, if they want to get themselves out of their obligation to redeem their wife, it's too expensive, it's too much money, he doesn't want to expend the money, he'll just take a neder ana'ah after she is taken into captivity, and then just put her ktubah into escrow and say, here, use this money to redeem her. If that's not enough, then I'm off the hook at this point. So it makes more sense to say that the neder ana'ah was in place beforehand, so it was an unforeseen outcome here that she was taken into captivity after the neder, but they were already on their way to divorce before she ever was taken into captivity. My love, what is the case here? B'madir eshet kohen kamiflegei. They're arguing here about an eshet kohen where there was this neder ana'ah taken. V'abaye d'amar ki Rabbi Eliezer. Abaye holds like Rabbi Eliezer. The Rabbi Eliezer says that you have to redeem, even when it is a situation in which they cannot get back together, you have to redeem them. So Abaye says that with regards to Ishid Kohen, and so does Rabbi Eliezer. V'Rava d'amar ki Rabbi Yeshua. On the other hand, Rava holds like Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua will say in that instance that he doesn't have to redeem her. And so too, Rava says in this case that there is no demand to redeem her. So in the instance where this was a scenario in which there was an Ishid Kohen, and there was a neder that preceded it, according to Abaye, there's no difference now whether there was a neder or not a neder. The only thing you can do is return her to Klal Yisrael, you can't marry her. So in that instance, Abaye says, we do force you to redeem the Eshet Kohen. And so does Rabbi Eliezer. So you have to redeem the Eshet Kohen. On the other hand, Rava says, in a case where there's an exogenous Isur that causes the problem here, in this case, the neder is what's causing the problem in the marriage. That preceded the problem of Shibya. And because of that, even if the Kohen was to redeem her, forget about Shibya, he would have been problematic. He couldn't have returned this woman because she was a Surah Ba'anatim, because he took a neder already. So according to Rava, you do not have to redeem in that case. And that's what Rabbi Yeshua says over here as well. So Mer says, lo, hacha b'may askinan. No, that's not. But what's the case here? Kigon shenadra ihi v'kiem lahu. She took the neder, and he was mikayimit. Rashi over here says, the Gemara now has moved on, Kolmar, Lolam Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, Lav beplukta debai v'rova plige. We're assuming now that Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua have nothing to do with the bai and rova. Vi b'isr devar acher, shal yedei neder, inami b'kohenet, ayedei neder. If it's a case of an extra isur, besides that of the neder, or it's a kohenet, by a neder, the kuliyama, Ike Abaye, Ike Rava. They either hold like Abaye or Rava. V'hocha, k'gon sh'nodrahi v'kiyem lahu. And here we're talking about an Ishit Yisrael. So now what Rashi says is, the Gemara has now left this possibility of it being an Ishit Kohen, and saying now we're talking about a Ishit Yisrael. And now we're trying to understand, within an Ishit Yisrael, what is the Machloket? But then Rashi says that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua have nothing to do with Abaye and Rava. Everybody either holds like Abaye or Rava. You can hold like either way. The problem with Rashi's interpretation here is that it's very hard to understand the Shita of Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yoshua. Because now he's saying that Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yoshua can either hold like Abaye and Rava, and then they're giving their explanation. But those reasons would make it implausible that Rabbi Eliezer, who thinks that it's his fault, then would have the same position as Rava with regards to an Eshet Kohen. So it's very hard to see how the machlok between Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua can be totally independent of the machlok of the Bayin Rova, and how you can align these shotot perfectly without their positions here coloring their views of Abaye and Rova. So there are Rishonim who disagree with Rashi and say the Gemara here says that we're still saying this is an explanation for Eshet Kohen and Eshet Yisrael. It's not just Eshet Yisrael now when the Gemara says Lo Achum La'eskinan, but it's also about Eshet Kohen. And because of that, it will remain a machloket tanaim for Rava, for sure. And for Abaye, maybe he can get himself to fit into Rabbi Yoshua, so that will be helpful because Rabbi Yoshua is the halacha. So now, what's the case here? Kigon shenadra ihi v'kiyem lahu. She took a neder, and he upheld it. Rabbi Lezer, savar hu notein etzba ben shina. Rabbi Lezer believes that he's the problem. Rabbi Yoshua, savar hi natna etzba ben shina. She's the problem. Question is, who do we blame over here? Does the blame go to the woman who took the neder? Or does the blame go to the husband who had the right to nullify it and instead upheld the neder? So since he had a veto right that he didn't exercise, does it become his issue? Or because she's the originator of the neder, it's really her issue. And so who do we blame over here? Rabbi Lezer says, we blame him. Since we blame him, he's got a redeemer. Because the necessity to collapse the marriage over here has to do with him. And since it's his fault, he's still got to redeem the woman. Now then, Rabbi Yeshua says the blame lays on her. And that's why they can't reconcile this marriage. If that's the case, he could just hand her a ketubah and say, you take care of yourself. There's no reason for me to redeem you if I can't have you as a wife anymore. And because you're the one who generated the problem. So the Gemara says, Ihi natna etzba ben shina. If she's to blame over here, Ketubah mayavita. If she's at fault, then she's not entitled to ketubah. If he's at fault, then she's entitled to ketubah. If a divorce is generated by problems caused by her, she's not entitled to ketubah. If we find that she's done something wrong, he divorces her and doesn't give her the ketubah. That's the penalty for doing something wrong. Now then, if he's the party that's causing the problem, she's entitled to her ketubah because she did nothing wrong. But in this case, if we're going to blame her, then why should she get her ketubah? Vitu, Amar Rabbi Natan, then we also have that Rabbi Natan clarified the situation with regards to Rabbi Yeshua's opinion. Shalte tzumchos kishamar Rabbi Yeshua noten lak tubata venu podeh kishidira lusof nishbeit. It's a case where there's a neder and then she was in captivity. Obshin nishbeit to lusof yidira. Or was it first that she was in captivity and then there's a neder? Vamar lo shamati. He said, I didn't know. I never heard about this. Ve'idi nadra ihi malihi dira lusof nishbeit. Malihi nishbeit lusof yidira. It should make absolutely no difference. If she is the one taking the neder, then she's the one generating the problem. We don't have any fear now of Irume, of him trying to get out of redeeming her, because she's the one who triggered the problem. She's the one who caused the problem.
Did it while she was
a captive. So based on what the Gemara is saying now, that would be the scenario, which seems unrealistic. Both from the perspective of why she did get a neder then, as well as why is that have any impact on the din that would come out of this? The question is not whether she can or cannot practically take the neder while she's a shfiya. The question is, why did Rabbi Natan care which way the order was in that situation? Because the order of when the neder was taken is irrelevant because she's the cause of the problem. If she's the one taking the neder, then he's certainly not doing this to get out of redeeming her. She's the one who caused him not to have to redeem her. Ella. So now the Gemara goes back and says, Lolam da'adra ihu. Clearly the case is that he took the neder. V'abaye mitaritz l'tamei. V'rava mitaritz l'tamei. And Abaye explains it according to his reasoning. And Rava explains it according to his reasoning. Abaye mitaritz l'tamei. Abaye explains it according to his reasoning. Almanala kohen gadol kuli amalo plige dechayav liftota. Everybody agrees. I mean, Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua both agree. When it comes to a kohen gadol to an almanah, everybody agrees you have to redeem her. Mamzeret v'nitin al Yisrael. If it's a problematic marriage with Israel, kuli amalo plige, de'enu chayav liftota. Everybody agrees that you do not have to redeem her. This is Abaye Lishitato, which says that there's two separate takanot. The takanah by Yisrael was all about the ability to return her as a wife. Here that will fail. So everybody agrees that there is no obligation to redeem her. On the other case, by the Amanala Kohen Gadol, by Kohen or Kohen Gadol, the only obligation is to return her to Kalal Yisrael. That obligation still exists because it hasn't changed by the fact that they're in an improper marriage. In a case where he takes a neder, and it's an Eshet Kohen, and then she's taken into captivity, he's still obligated to redeem her. That's no different than Amanala Kohen Gadol. The question of whether the Isur is a improper marriage, or is the Isur the neder, that they can't remain married. But either way, that makes no difference over here, according to Abaye. Because Abaye says the obligation by Kohen is just simply to return her to Kalal Yisrael, and he still can accomplish that. Keep Lige. So where's the Machloket of Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua? But Madir Eshet Yisrael. By a neder of an Eshet Yisrael. Rabbi Elazar, Azal Batar Mi'ikara. Rabbi Elazar goes after the original state of their marriage. So he's obligated then, because when they were originally married, they had a fine marriage. This was Yisrael married to a woman that he was properly married to. The problem only arose after the neder was made in the middle of their marriage. So if I look at the time that he obligated himself in sense of niktubah, that's what we're looking at now. At the time of niktubah, he could accomplish returning this woman to him as a wife. And since he can accomplish that, he is obligated to do so. But Rabbi Shua says, Azel Bater Sof. We go after the end. It's not clear what Sof means. Sof can be one of two things. Either the time of captivity or the time of redemption. Obviously, they don't have nafkamino. One big nafkamino is when the neder was taken. But we'll assume here, Bater Sof means not at the time that he obligated himself in the ketubah, but the time that this captivity takes place. By the time we're talking about this scenario here, the neder is already in place, and she is illegal to be his wife, improper wife now because of the neder. So the machloket is very narrow according to Abaye. The only case where they have a machloket is when there was a neder by Eshet Yisrael. Do we view that as undermining the obligation to redeem her? Or do we see that simply as a variable that was entered in after he was already obligated to redeem her? He was obligated to redeem her at the time that he entered into the contract of the ketubah. At that point, there was nothing inhibiting him from doing that. And therefore, when she's taken captive later, he has to fulfill that obligation. Oh, there was a neder in between. We don't pay attention to that. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua says, no. The question is, at the time of captivity, can we still accomplish what was agreed upon in the ketubah? And the answer is no. Since we can't accomplish that, he's not obligated to redeem her. That's Abaye's explanation of the machloket. Rava mitaretz l'tamei. Rava will explain according to his reasoning, which is, amanah l'kohen gadol mamzer nitan al Yisrael. So again, here, you see Rava combining the two issues, because according to him, there's only one takana, which is the question of whether this woman is in a proper marriage or not in a proper marriage. So therefore, an amanah l'kohen gadol, mamzer nitan al Yisrael, kuli amah lo pligi, deinu chayav liftota. Everybody agrees that there's no need for redemption over here, because it's very clear. This is an improper wife. You can't accomplish what the ketubah was set out to do, which is return this woman to you as a wife. Okay, by a kohen, there's a technical problem, but still, we want you to return her. Over here, neither of those cases would ever get off the ground because it was an improper marriage. Ki pligei. So then where do they argue? Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar, but madir ben eshet kohen, ben eshet Yisrael. We take a neder or not, whether it's an eshet kohen, whether it's eshet Yisrael, again, no differentiation for Rava. Rabbi Elazar azal batar mikara. Blazer goes after the time of the signing of the ketubah. At the time of the signing of the ketubah, this individual could have accomplished what he was supposed to do, which was return this woman to him as a wife, or for Kohen to Klal Yisrael. But Rabbi Yeshua says, Azel Bat Yosef. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua says, we go after the current status of their marriage. The current status of their marriage is, it's not going to last. There's no continuation of this marriage, and therefore they fail in terms of the necessity to redeem her and bring her back as a wife. Again, by the Kohen, even though technically he can't bring her back as a wife anyway, still, we're looking at the Takanah from a core. The core is whether this individual, if he was Yisrael, could bring her back as a wife. Kohen technically can't remain married to her, but that's still not the issue. The issue is whether this woman could be brought back. The answer is yes, but according to Rabbi Yeshua, the answer is no, because at this point, the neder is causing a problem for us. The neder would have caused them to divorce, irrespective of this pidyon, and therefore the obligation falls away because she's no longer able to be brought back as a wife, whether it's Yisrael or a kohen, she won't be able to be brought back as a wife. All right, Gemara continues. Nishbeit chayav liftota. Tarabanan, nishbeit b'chayei bala. She was taken into captivity during the lifetime of her husband. V'chakach meit bala. Then her husband passes away. Hikir ba bala. If the husband knew of the captivity, he was aware of the captivity, yoshim chayevin liftota. Then the yoshim are obligated to redeem her because the encumberment of his property to the redemption of this woman happened during his lifetime. So since that lien existed prior to his death, when the yoshim inherit, they inherit the land with that encumbrance, with that lien on the property. Lo yikir ba bala. On the other hand, if her husband never knew about the captivity, then the lien never exists. Which is interesting in of itself, because it doesn't, the reality is that she is in captivity, but what we're suggesting here is that a lien can only be effectuated if the party on whom the lien is being placed knows about the lien. But if they don't know about it, then the lien doesn't exist yet. That's the case. And yoshim chayavim liftota. The inheritors will not be obligated to redeem her because the lien didn't exist. And then they become the first rights on the property because they are inheritors. And she doesn't have a lien. And after the death of the husband, she can't obligate the yoshim to pay for her to be redeemed. It's not part of their obligation. It's not their chiyuv. It's their property now. And they don't have to redeem her from their property. Levi Savar Lemeavad Uvda Kiamatnito. Levi thought to act lahalacha based on this braita, the differentiation between whether the husband knew about it or didn't know about it. Amalei Rav, Hachi Amar Chavivi. So Rav says to Levi, this is what Chavivi in Rav's eyes is Rabbi Chia. So again, we know that Rav lives at that point of transition from the Tanaim to Amoraim. So over here you see Levi, who's a Talmud of Rabbi. You have Rabbi Chia, who's a Talmud of Rabbi. And Rav, who's a Talmud of Rabbi. And over here, Rav is saying to Levi, listen, Rabbi Chia said this, and therefore we have Tanaim that are disagreeing with the Braita that you brought down. Halacha is not like that Braita, Elikiha, the Tanya, but rather like this Braita. Nishbeit lachar mitat bala. If she's taken to captivity after her husband passes away, ene yitomim chayvim liftota. Then the yitomim have no obligation to redeem her. V'lo old. Ela afilu nishbeit b'chayi bala. If she was taken to captivity during the lifetime of her husband, v'racha kach meit bala, and then the husband dies, ene yitomim chayvim liftota. Yitomim do not have to redeem her. She'en ani kureba v'otvineich li'intu. Because then the fulfillment of the redemption does not result in her returning as a wife, because he's not there anymore, so she can't be his wife. Therefore, the yoshim are completely exempt. Whether this happened during the lifetime of the Baal, whether this did not happen during the lifetime of the Baal. So it's clear here that Levi was trying to do this in a scenario where the husband knew about it. The husband knew about the captivity, died, and then the land was passed to the yoshim. Levi wanted to force the yoshim to redeem the woman. In the end, Rav comes along and says, that's not the case. Because we have this braita, which Rabbi Chia says is normative. No matter what the scenario is, the yoshim are never obligated to redeem. And therefore, you can't compel the yoshim over here to redeem her, because the Tanai Ketubah are very particular, which says that you redeem her to bring her back as a wife. That doesn't exist in this scenario. And because it doesn't exist, the yoshim don't have any obligation. Isha Kohen, right, could be different over here. That would depend on Abaye and Rava, basically, how literally we take the requirement of an Isha Kohen. According to Abaye, it would be likely that you would have to redeem in that case, versus Rava would say that you don't, because Rava just says it's the Yisrael's Tnai Eik Tuba, just this effectuality by Kohen. So since the Yisrael can't accomplish it, a Kohen wouldn't be obligated as well. All right, so now the Gemara says, Tan Rabbanan, Nishbeit, Vayu Mivakshim Yemenu Ad Asara B'damea. She was taken into captivity. And now they're asking for 10 times her value. Pam rishona podet. The first time, he redeems her. Mikan ve'elech. From there on forward, ratza podet, ratza eno podet. If he wants to redeem her, he can redeem her. If he doesn't want to redeem her, he doesn't have to redeem her. So this is interesting. Machloket Rashi and the Rabbeinu Chanan has had to read this. Rashi literally says, ratza eno podet, lo tokinu barabana elechad pidyon. Chachamim only obligated him in one redemption. Once he's made that redemption, he's now exempt from redeeming this woman. And it won't matter what the cost is the second time around. He can walk away and say that, not my problem, not my issue. because I fulfilled my obligations under the ketubah to redeem this woman once. She got into trouble a second time, not my problem. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tosafot Rabbi explains that doesn't make any sense. We'll see that in the upcoming Gemara. Gemara will ask a question. According to Rashi, the question should equally apply to the Tanakama as it does to Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Since the Gemara only asks it in Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Tosafot believes that it's clear here that you can redeem, that he is obligated to redeem the woman the second time. So what's the difference between the first time and the second time? The first time he has to pay, no matter what the money is. Up to 10 times her value, he has to pay. On the other hand, the second time, he only has to pay her value, or at least up to the value of a ketubah, but he still has to redeem her. He can't just leave her. Tosafot over here argues about whether it's considered to be matsui or enu matsui. And so therefore, the Gemara earlier said that the difference between mizonot and maasei yadah, which is definitely matsui, and the other cases seem to be that they were enu matsui. The question is, where do peirot and pidyon fall into that category? Are they considered to be matsui or enu matsui? Vura and ketubah. The case of dowry versus ketubah, that happens once in a lifetime, that a person collects on that. If that happens once in a lifetime, that's what's called enu matsui. Now I look at pidyon. Is pidyon considered to be matsui because it happens more than once? Or is it considered to be enu matsui because it only happens once in a lifetime? So Tosafot discusses that according to Rashi versus what his explanation is as to whether the pidyon is considered to be something that's matsui or enu matsui. According to Rashi, peirot and pirkon are considered to be enu matsui. Aval kvura chashiva matsui. But kvura is considered to be matsui. Efisha nashim imarot amot min anashim. That women tend to predecease their husbands. Well, how times have changed. In their day, it was likely that the woman would predecease her husband, especially because of childbirth. The likelihood that the woman would live longer than her husband was very low. And therefore, it was almost a given that he would be burying his wife during his lifetime. But today, it's the opposite way around. The lifespan of women exceeds that of men. And the likelihood is the other way around, that most women will be burying their husbands. So therefore, Rashi will explain matsui by maasei yadayim and by the case of gvura, and eino matsui by pidyon. Tosafot, on the other hand, says that no, gvura is considered to be eino matsui, and pidyon and maasei yadayim are considered to be matsui. Because pidyon might happen more than once. It's not just the once in a lifetime. It could happen multiple times. And therefore, he quotes from the Rabbeinu Kananel, who suggests over here, the Ratzah, enu poder migdei michdei mchameh. If he chooses to redeem her for more than her value, he can. If he chooses not to, he doesn't have to. But he still has to redeem her at her value, or at least at the value of her ketubah. So that's how Tosafot reads it. Rashi again reads it, that you only have one obligation, period. And then after that, you have no obligation whatsoever. What's interesting in the Tanakhama's position over here is that he says that up to 10 times her value, you do have to redeem her. Beyond that, we don't obligate you because it's considered to be excessive, even the first time. But Tosafot says, we have a machloket with regards to why we do not redeem captives in the cases of excessive value. Mishnah says it's because of tikkun olam. Maamorim argue, what is the tikkun olam over there? Is it a problem for the tzibur? Which is that if we do this, it's going to drain the coffers of the tzibur. If we have to pay this much each time, there's no way we're going to keep pace with this. Is it that we're going to encourage them to do it again? The more you pay, the more you encourage them to do this. So Tosafot says, from this quote right here, we should be able to prove. And the reason has to do with duchaka de tzibur, because here he's allowed to pay up to 10 times their value. Now, if we were worried about him stimulating this type of captivity again, then why would we allow him to pay that much? Here, he's personally paying it. So there's no duchat de tzibur. So the reason here must be that it's duchat de tzibur, and that's why we let him pay an excessive amount. Tosafot in the end rejects that and says that's not the case. Could be that we're even worried about causing more problems of shvuyin, but nevertheless, we still would have this conclusion. And that is because when it comes to adam atzmo, for a person himself, he's allowed to make a decision as to how much he wants to pay to redeem himself. The only question in the Mishnah in Gittin is with regards to other people redeeming. When other people redeem, it's a question of how much they want to spend, whether this is going to cause problems in the Tikkun Olam. When it comes to an individual about themselves, V'yesh Lomar, the field of the time is a little groove, late to Tfei, lo takinush, lo yuchal livdot the damet etzmo yoter michtei damav. Chazal never stopped a person from redeeming himself with his own money, up to whatever he wants to pay. Or, ba'ad or, v'chol asher le'ish, yitain ba'ad nafsho. Person's willing to give up everything to live. So he can make that choice. V'hacha, ishto kigufo. His wife is like his guf, and therefore he has the right to pay as much as he wants, irrespective of the takanot that were established in the Gemara in Gittin. It's a very interesting position of Tosafot. That's what it says, that for a father to a daughter would not apply, because it's not bitos, not kegufo. And therefore, they would be governed by the rules of the Gittin or the Tikkun Olam. It's only by yourself and your wife, for ishto kegufo. Only in those scenarios can a person expend as much money as they want in redemption of a captive. In the 70s, there was a plane that was hijacked to Jordan, and at the time, the Rosh Hashiva of Neri Sot, Rav Ruderman, was on that plane, and his Talmidim offered huge sums of ransom to get him out, and there were a lot of questions asked about whether halakhically they were permitted to do such a thing when they were trying to redeem him in that scenario. And obviously today, in the modern issues, I mean, this is for the Gemara in Gittin and not for here, but in the modern issues of trading prisoners for captured soldiers, the question of paying, quote unquote, too much, this issue, again, is on the table. And halakhically, there are stadim to both sides here. Again, it's not our topic, but unfortunately, it was always an issue for the Jewish community, but even in the modern state, it still is, remains an issue because of our soldiers being taken into captivity. Rav Shimon Gamliel says, "In podim eshvim yoter al kadei yidmeihem." We do not redeem captives, period, more than their value, mipnei tikkun olam, for the reason of Tikkun Olam, which is the reasons brought in the Gemara and Gittin. How do you know what Kedei Demehem is? Rashi says, you go sell them in the Shuk and find out. So when you have an active slave market, you can find out how much a person is worth. You don't pay more than you would pay for this individual in the slave market, and that determines their true value. Because otherwise it would be very subjective, and then, in a sense, you would defeat the purpose. If you couldn't come up with an objective value for an individual, then every person will say, well, they're worth so much to me, I can pay as much as I want. So here, obviously, Rashi says the objective value is how they would sell in the shuk. Ha bichtei demeihem podim. But, on the other hand, what is implied by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is that if they were at value, you would have to redeem them. Afagavde pirkuna yoter aktubata. Even though her redemption exceeds the value of her ktuba. Very many. Is that really true? Nishbeit vayu mevakshim imenu adasara biktubata. She was taken into captivity and they were asking for 10 times her ktubah, pam rishona podeh, the first time he redeems her, mikam ve'elech, ratza podeh, ratza einu podeh. Rav Shimon Gamliel omer, imaya pirkona keneged ktubata podeh, if her redemption equals her ktubah, then he does it. Im lav, einu podeh. If not, then he doesn't redeem her. So the second version of this says that Rav Shimon Gamliel has a cap on the amount that he has to pay, which is the ktubah. In the first instance, there's no cap on what he has to pay. It's only determined by what her value is. He can't exceed her value. So here we have a stira in the position of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. In one case, he says, it doesn't matter how much, as long as it doesn't exceed her true value. In the second case, it says he's capped out by the amount of her ketubah. Right, because here, Tosafot actually raises, it's really a Tosafot back from the Mishnah before, what we discussed, why is there a difference between peyrot and mizonot? And Tosafot over here says that by mizonot, again, he's received the benefit of the ma'aseh yadayim, and she's received the benefit of the mizonot. It's done. In the case of peirot and pirkon, he's been eating peirot all along, and he's never benefited her with the pidyon. So that's why we said before that he's obligated in the pidyon. He can't just walk away and hand her a ketubah, because he already got the benefits of the peirot. He has to do his share of the obligation. That's obvious that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel feels differently about this. And the Gemara says, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, trei kulei itle. He has two kulot, which is, you pay the lesser of. You pay the lesser of her true value, or her ketubah. Whichever is less, that is the cap on what the husband has to put in terms of the redemption of this woman. Either up to the value of her ketubah, the value of her ketubah here would probably be the nedunya part of it. It's not the core ketubah that we're speaking about, but rather the excess that was given within the ketubah. Then up to that value, then he has to redeem her. Or, if her value is less than that, he would only have to pay up to her value. If her value exceeds that, then he'd be capped out at the ketubah. So it's the lesser of these two items. Kulot, yes, Ephraim, because we're moving from a personal obligation to a communal obligation. Where does his personal obligation end, and where does the communal obligation kick in? So here, these caps, according to Bishim Gomer, are the caps on his personal obligation. Then that falls to the tzibor, and the tzibor then adds in the communal obligation kicks in at that point. So that's what we're discussing here. Where's that threshold between personal obligation versus communal obligation? So we're not going to leave her in captivity. The question is, who's going to get her out of captivity? Right? Lakta chayav l'rapota. If she falls ill, he has to cure her, heal her, get her a doctor. Tana banan. Amana nizonet minechse yitomim. Vitzricha refu'a harihi kimizonot. An almana has the right to get mizonot out of the nechasim of the yitomim. That's one of the tanayei ketuba, is that the almana, when she's widowed, she's allowed to remain in the estate and then draw an allowance from the estate for her mizonot, for sustaining herself. Since refuah is like mizonot, therefore she can collect them like mizonot. She can take monies for her medical bills because they are just like mizonot. B'shem Gamliel omer, refuah sheish la kitzva nitrapat miktubata. Refuah that has a limit. I mean, this is not a chronic issue. This is not going to be something that's going on for a limitless amount of time. It's got a limited scope to it. We know exactly how much it's going to cost. She pulls that out of her ketubah. Shame like kitzvah. If there's no limit to the payment, arihi ki mizonot. Then it's like mizonot. What Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says is, the whole reason you're telling me refuah is like mizonot is because they're both there for her sustenance. But then let's look at the nature of mizonot. The nature of mizonot is that it's an unlimited, an open check. That basically anytime she needs food, or she, as long as she lives, she's entitled to take this. So if you want to compare refuah to that, then it's got to be refuah that's similar. That's got to be refuah that is either chronic or refuah that has a limitless amount of payment. That can come out of the estate, that can be paid like mizonot. On the other hand, if it's a one-time cost or a fixed cost where we know the scope of the cost, Shimon Gamliel says that's taken out of the ketubah, not out of mizonot. That'll be deducted from her ketubah, because that's a fixed expense, and it doesn't look like mizonot anymore, and therefore it'll come out of her ketubah. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan asu hakazat dam b'Eretz Yisrael k'rufuah she'en la kitzvah. They made hakazat dam, bloodletting, in Eretz Yisrael, the equivalent of a rufuah that has no limit to it, basically allowing her to get it out of the mizonot. So that was an entitlement of the woman, that if she needed hakazat dam, that was the equivalent of en la kitzvah, or rufuah she'en la kitzvah. If that's the case, she's entitled to get that as part of her allowance out of the estate. Kravid Rabbi Yochanan Avalu Itat Abba. The relatives of Rabbi Yochanan, these Yitomim, had a stepmother. It was their father's wife. Obviously not their mother, but their father's wife. Tavat Tzricha Refua Koyoma. She needed medical attention every day. Atu the Gamed Rabbi Yochanan, they came before Rabbi Yochanan Avalu. Izilu Kotzului Mide Lerofe. Go and set up a fixed payment with the doctor. Basically say, here's a lump sum, take care of her for the rest of her life, or this is the amount that we're going to have to pay in order to deal with this situation. Once they do that, it changes the dynamic. Until this point in time, it seems something that was chronic, and every day she needed to go to the doctor, then that becomes like mizonot, because ein la kitzvah. There's no end. We don't know when she's going to pass away. We don't know how long this is going to last. Ein la kitzvah is like mizonot. She can take that out of the estate. What Rabbi Yochanan advised them to do is basically make it into a fixed payment. If you make it into a fixed payment, then according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, it's no longer mizonot, it's a deduction from the ketubah. And that way they'll protect themselves, because now the estate will no longer have to pay for it, and actually it'll come out of her ketubah. She'll actually lose money this way, because it's going to come out of the principal of her ketubah. So if she ever tries to collect her ketubah, she will get less. It doesn't come out of the estate and preserve her ketubah in that instance. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Asinu atzmenu korchea dayanim. He says, that was a mistake. I just made myself into a lawyer. I basically just advised one of the litigants in favor of the other one. He basically advised these yitomim, who are his relatives, a way to protect the estate and basically forced the woman to take this payment out of her ketubah instead of as mizanot, as incremental to her ketubah. Mikara my savar, olusof my savar. What was he thinking originally when he gave them the advice? And what was he thinking afterwards when he felt bad about doing this? Mikara savar umibsarcha lo titalem. In the beginning, he felt these are relatives and there's an obligation to take care of your relatives. So he intervened on behalf of his relatives to protect them and give them advice that would help them. But sof savar, adam chashuv shaini. A person of my stature, I can't play favorites. I can't advise my relatives or help out my relatives here because it looks like I'm not being impartial in these cases. And by advising them, I'm actually tipping the scales in their favor, and people will look on that as being a conflict of interest or nepotism of sorts, and that's not befitting or becoming of a person of my stature. All right, next Mishnah. Lo katav la benin dechrin, ta'avalai cheminai inun yartun kesef ketubeteich, yeter achu kahon dim al-gon. If they do not write in the ketubah, basically what's called ketubah benin dechrin, the male children that are born to you, they will inherit the value of your ketubah. in excess of what their brothers being half-brothers here, will inherit from the estate. Chayav, it nevertheless is an obligation. Shehu tenai beitin is an automatic condition of beitin that a marriage or ktubah exists with this condition. Bnan nukvan diavin laichei minai, female children, daughters that are born from our marriage, they will stay in my house and be sustained out of my possessions until they are taken as wives. I mean, until husbands come and take them as wives. Chayav, again, even if it's not written, obligation to give mizonot to the banot out of the estate until they get married. Shutnai beitin, again, it is a condition of beitin. At te yatva bebeiti umidzana minichsai koyume megar amunutech bebeiti. As long as you remain a widow and live in my house as a widow, you will be entitled to take your allowance, take mizonot out of the estate. So that is a, again, condition. Chayav, even if he doesn't write it, it's an obligation. Shutnai beitin. That is a tnai beitin. Kacha yu anshe Yerushalayim kotvin. This is the way that the ktubot of anshe Yerushalayim read, which is that the widow had this choice. Anshe Galil ayu kotvin ke anshe Yerushalayim. And the people of the Galil had the same nusach as those of Yerushalayim. Anshe Yehuda kotvin through the choice from the widow to the yitomim, to the orphans. Ad shi yiratzu ayorshim liten lecha ktubatech. Basically, what the determining factor here is, as long as she stays a widow in the household, she's allowed to collect mizonot. As soon as she takes her ktubah, it's over. It's either or. Either she stays and sustains out of the estate, or she collects her ktubah. Who has that choice? According to Anshei Yerushalayim and the Anshei Galil, the choice is the widow's choice. As long as you remain in the house as a widow, you can keep getting mizonot. So it's her choice. She wants to remain, she'll get mizonot. She doesn't want to remain, she collects her ktubah and walks away. On the other hand, the way the Anshei Yehuda wrote it was that it's the Yitomim's choice. Yitomim can make a decision as to whether give her ktubah and rid themselves of the obligation, in a sense, to sustain her. Here's your ktubah, take care of yourself. Or they can determine that she can stay here and they can give her a sustainer through the mizonot. So who has the decision is the question here, that the way the nusach ktubah. According to Galil and Yerushalayim, it's the woman's decision, the widow's decision. According to Yerushalayim, it's the Yitomim's decision. Therefore, the Yitomim have that choice to basically give her a ktubah and say, you're out. Because we don't want to have to sustain her for so long. The ktubah, or the value of the ktubah, you look in Chumash, the Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch makes actually a very detailed calculation as to how the ktubah actually would help out a woman to get to the point where she could get married again or give her sustenance in this situation. And he talks about the value of the ktubah based on what he thinks would be a normal woman's needs over a certain duration of time. And therefore, the ktubah is basically the present value of what would have been the mizonot out of the estate. Right, obviously there's an actuarial question over here and that won't always be equal. There he's talking about a young girl. How does that payment help her to get to the point where she can get married? I'm Rabbi Yochanan Mishom Rabbi Shimba Yochai. Mipnei ma itzkinu ktubat binin dichrin. Why did they establish this concept of ktubat binin dichrin? Kedei shikpots adam yichtov limto kibno. The reason was to encourage a father to give more of the dowry the way that he would give to his son. Now, obviously he would give to his son as much as he wants because, first of all, it's his son. Number two is he knows it will remain within the family of his son because the children, the grandchildren will inherit his son, and therefore it will remain within the blood family. His blood grandchildren will inherit his son, who is his blood son. On the other hand, in a case where he gives property to his daughter, there's a possibility, if we did not have ktubah binin dichrin, that what would happen is that this man took multiple wives. His daughter is one of those wives. In this case where his daughter predeceases this husband, the husband's the inheritor of the woman's ktubah, of the dowry. He inherits the dowry, then he passes away, even if she had children. But even more so if she didn't have children, then the inheritors of this dowry will be people who the father of this girl had no relationship to whatsoever. They're not his grandchildren. They have nothing to do with him at all. Meantime, all this property is going to be transferred over to these other parties. So in order to encourage the father to give property and not worry about that, we basically said that his blood grandchildren would be the inheritors, or grandsons will be the inheritors of the dowry. So that means that male children born to this daughter of his, they will have the first right of inheritance to the dowry. And then after that, they will divide up the property of their father. So in this way, the father knows that the property will go to his daughter, and then from the daughter to his blood grandsons. And in that case, he'd be more willing or more apt to give more money or more in the dowry. It says, How could it be? There's a case here where the Torah says that the inheritance belongs to a son. In the meantime, we're going to make it that the daughter inherits. So not literally the daughter and the son over here, but basically, Min HaTorah, the husband, inherits his wife, and his male children are the inheritors, split up evenly. Meantime, what we're going to do is say no, that the real inheritor here of the husband's property is his wife, or the daughter of the one who gave the dowry originally, and then she's going to pass that to her male sons. So we're basically undermining the Yerusha Min HaTorah. Do we do that? Chachamim come in and say that the daughter can inherit. It says, Ha Nami Do Raito. That's also Min HaTorah Dichtiv. Now it's interesting. The Gemara says it's Min HaTorah and quotes a pasuk from Navi. So it's obviously not Min HaTorah. But what the Gemara is saying here is that the Chachamim did not just invent this, but rather there's precedence in Tanakh, or we see clearly from Navi or Min HaTorah, that we should try to create larger dowries, or that we should try to do this, and therefore the Chachamim then came and established the Takana to facilitate the ability for fathers to give larger dowries, which is, k'chu nashim, take wives, and then have children, k'chu livnechem nashim, and take for your children wives, v'et benotechem tznu l'nashim, and then your daughters you should give to men. So here it's talking about when they go into Galut, he's telling you, you're going to have to reestablish your lives. You should have full-fledged, fulfilling lives. You get married and have children, and then your children, you should marry them off. Bishlam banim biyadei kaime. When it comes to his children, he has control. His sons, he can marry them off, because they can choose a wife, and then they can marry them off. Ela benatei mi kaimin biyadei. What's in his control in terms of marrying off his daughter? He has to have a suitor who comes and asks for his daughter's hand in marriage. He doesn't control the fact that there's someone going to take his daughter. Someone has to come and ask for his daughter as a wife. It says, Akamash Malan, he should adorn her, dress her, and give her things, to encourage people to want to marry her. Then they will come and marry her. So what is that? That's a dowry. So basically what they're saying is, the larger the dowry, the more impetus there is for someone to come and marry this woman. So how do you marry off your daughter in the sense that you can trigger the marriage? Right. It'd make it monetarily fulfilling to marry this woman. So therefore, the dowry is an encouraging factor here. So that's what it means. So you see in the Pasuk in Navi that a father has the obligation to ensure that both his sons and daughters get married. His sons he can do because they're the suitors. So he can go out and ask for other women to marry their sons. But by his daughters, he has to wait. How does he encourage someone to come and inquire about his daughter? He enlarges the dowry, makes sure that she looks beautiful, that she's dressed well, and those items. So you see that there is a value in a large dowry. And because of that, the Chachamim came and facilitated that by creating the Ketubat Benin Dichrin. Ve'ad kama, how much value can be granted towards a dowry? By Ramre Damre Tavayu, Bosei Ad Isur Nichsei, up to a tenth of his possessions. If the father passes away, and now we're taking it out of the estate to pay for the dowry of a girl, what is the maximum amount she can take out of there? 10% of the estate. Tosafot earlier, discusses whether this 10% is governed by what the father did before or not. We said that there is this idea that we look at what the father did for his first daughter, or what would be his normal presentation in these cases. So Tosafot over there said that this is a ceiling. 10% is the cap. So it's the lesser of 10% or what the father would have given. But if the father would have been more generous and given even more than 10%, we're capped out at 10%. That's the way Tosafot reads it. Obviously, you can argue on Tosafot and say that the 10% is just a cap in instances where we don't know that the father gave more. But in cases where we know the father gave more, maybe we would even give more. Obviously, that has to do with the number of daughters in the estate and what's going to be left over for the sons afterwards. So there are other considerations here as well. Vema, the Av li wrote, the Baal lo li wrote, what the Av donates to the Ketubah, the dowry, then that will go to Ketubah Benin Dichren, the grandsons will inherit. The Baal, that which the Baal gives in, which is the core Ketubah, and the Tosefet Ketubah, they will not inherit. That was the husband's contribution, and therefore that should go into the regular buckets of Yerusha. It shouldn't be governed by the parties or the male sons of this wife. So what we're saying is divide it up. If you're trying to increase the dowry is the only factor here. So if the dowry is the factor, then let that be under this umbrella of ketubah b'nin dechren, but the remainder of the ketubah should not be under this. So he says, im kein av nami mimneh velo katov. If that's the case, the father will not give a generous dowry, because he will say, basically, if the husband's not willing to give to my grandsons, then why should I be willing? He's, in a sense, being miserly and holding on to this for his children, then I'll hold on to this for my children. The only way we're going to encourage the father to loosen up his purse strings is if the husband himself also loosens up his purse strings and grants that to the male children of this woman. Therefore, if the entire ketubah goes to them, then the father will also be encouraged to make his donation to his grandchildren. So let us say here, when there's a dowry, when the father puts money into the marriage, then we'll have the ketubah b'nin dechren, because then we can encourage the husband to do the same thing, because that triggers the father's giving of more or loosening his purse strings. That will incentivize the father. But in a case where the father's not giving a dowry anyway, why should we force the baal to put in the ketubah b'nin dechren? Because there's no reason for the incentive anymore. The father's not giving anything, so why should the baal have to give anything? Where it says, slow plug, rabbanon. The Rabbanan didn't differentiate between these types of cases. They have a standard Lashon in the Ketubah. Whether there is a dowry or no dowry, this is the way that the Ketubah is written. This is the way it's going to work. Bat ben abanim, nami tirot. If this woman only has a daughter, and the husband does have sons, but from other women. So let's say over there that the daughter should be the beneficiary of this Ketubah b'nin dechren. As you know already, that's not the case, because it's called Ketubah b'nin dechren. The Ketubah belonging to the male sons, it doesn't go to the daughter. Why is that? The Rabbanan made it like inheritance, like an estate inheritance. And just like by Nachla, Bat Ben Abanim does not inherit, so too, Ketubah Ben Nechren is not relevant when there is a daughter amongst sons. Bat Ben Abanot Tirot. So that's right out of the case, he only has daughters. And therefore, maybe Ketubah Ben Nechren should divide up, basically the daughters should get their mother's Ketubah, just like the boys would get their mother's Ketubah. Where it says, Lo Plug Rabbanan, again, the Rabbanan, we do not differentiate in ketubot. All ketubot are written the same way. And since all ketubot are written, number one, in a way that the entire ketubah goes to the benin dechrin. Number two is it only goes to benin dechrin, doesn't go to females. And number three is that even when they're females only, it still is not in force, because normally that would not be the case. And therefore, we do not change the takana in this case. B'tikve mimetaltele, let them collect the ketubah benin dechrin even out of non-real property. Ketubah shavua rabbanon. The Rabbanan made it like a ketubah. So what does that mean? Ketubah only has a lien on his real property. It does not have a lien on his metaltalin. So since it's an extension of the ketubah, he only has a lien on the property. And by the way, Tosafot here raises again the takanat gilunim, which says that metaltalin today are equal to karka. And if that's the case, ketubah b'nin dechren would be taken out of metaltalin, because the Gemara here says that ketubah b'nin dechren equals ketubah. So if the Gonim say ketubah can be collected at metaltalim like karka, like real property, that means that ketubah b'nin nechrin, which is equal to ketubah, will also be allowed to be collected out of metaltalim. So that's what Tosafot says based on the taknata gedonim. So titzrof mimishabde. So let us take it out of encumbered property. Yartun tnan. The lashon of the ketubah says yartun, that they are yorshim. Yorshim don't have a right to go collect out of encumbered property. They only get what's left over, not what was already taken by other parties. Veima afagav deleka motar dinar. Let us say that even if there's a not in excess of all the ketubot here, more money, because what happens here is that if there's not in excess of all the ketubot, then basically you're going to have the yusha be divided up based on the ketubot of the women, and then there'll be nothing left over that's going to be split evenly between all of the half-brothers here. So when it says, makom tegomi akra nachla doraita lo tokinu rabbanon, where we're going to eliminate Yerushami doraita completely, there is no takana derabanan. So therefore, only if the estate exceeds the value of all the ketubot will we allow the ketubot benin dechren to go through. Because that excess value beyond all the ketubot will then be divided up evenly between all of these half-brothers, and that'll be mekayim Yerusha deoraita. So as long as there's an excess of a dinar beyond the value of all his wives' ketubot, will we say that ketubot benin dechren is triggered? Because then you'll have the takana derabanan apply as well as Yerusha deoraita. But if the value of the estate is beneath the value of the total value of all the ketubot of his wives, then we will not invoke ketubah b'nin nechren, because then there'll be no inheritance midoraita. And therefore we'll just go by inheritance deoraita. Okay, we're going to stop over here. Three lines from the bottom of Nun Bet, Amud Bet.